In my case, it was years of procrastination and fear. I was paralyzed. My book was sitting in my drawer. I was devastated, and I knew that. So it wasn't just like, well, I'm still working on my book. I couldn't put it out. And so when the cost of perfectionism is joy or connection with others and isolation, I don't want it. So I'll always choose joy and connection and imperfection, because I don't know, I think perfection does not build connection, right?
Hello, it's Steph, and welcome to episode 58 of the Creating Happy Writers podcast. Thank you for joining me today, whether it be your very first time or you're back for another listen. I'm a multi-published author and writing coach on a mission to take the overwhelm, confusion, and frustration out of the writing process and give you the confidence and the knowledge to pursue your writing goals. You can get further support from me in my book, Dare to Write, which takes you all the way from your initial book idea to published manuscript. It's at stephcaswell.com/shop or on Amazon. Links to the book will be in my show notes. Right, let's crack on with today's episode, shall we? It's another guest episode, and this time I'm talking to the wonderful Natalia Andrasova. Natalia is an award-winning writer and dissertation coach with over 2 decades of teaching and coaching experience. She has coached professional writers and university writers of all skill levels, students, staff, and faculty. Her passion is helping writers become more courageous, authentic, and kind to themselves. Through individual coaching, writing groups, and writing retreats, she's helped hundreds of writers to break through blocks and find inspiration, a more authentic voice, and a greater freedom in their writing and their life. She lives in Toronto, Canada, and when she's not writing or meditating, she loves to play tennis, practice yoga, or sit by the water and cloud watch for hours. In her own writing practice spanning 3 decades, she discovered that beliefs we have about our writing are not different from the beliefs we have about ourselves. So a new way of writing often translates into a new way of living. What was impossible becomes probable and even likely when we learn to write and live without fear. During our wonderful conversation, we talk about how to approach your writing as a joyful practice, a little like you might treat a yoga practice, and creating a space, both mentally and physically, that can help you complete your best work. Natalia's advice on managing writer's block and how to feel inspired and motivated to continue, even when managing that voice of self-doubt. The importance of self-compassion in the writing process and how we should all embrace the journey for what it is, full of ups and downs and twists and turns. Natalia's own writing process and how she approaches each book she writes and how she uses that to support the writers she works with too. And so much more. Natalia has such a wonderful way with words, both in written form, but also when talking about her passion for writing. I hope you enjoy listening to her as much as I enjoyed having the conversation with her. So do you want to tell everybody how you got to be doing what you do today?
I had a job at the Writing Centre at my university, Toronto Metropolitan University, and I was helping writers one-on-one. I was running groups. I was running writing retreats for grad students. And then students from other universities just kept asking me if they could join because they were also working on their PhD or their master's thesis. And they were also lonely and isolated. And I was running this, I'm still a PhD student myself, I was finishing. So I was running these groups, either stress-free writing or writing for wellness or, you know, just for grad students, like doctoral bootcamp, PhD bootcamp or dissertation bootcamp. And I had to say no. I would run to my manager several times and like, can they join? Can they join? But of course, the university couldn't allow other students. So I started helping other graduate students from other universities on the weekends and in the evenings because they were just like me. I couldn't let them struggle. And, you know, I think slowly I went from struggling with my own process, you know, and feeling overwhelmed and stressed and kind of stuck to transforming my practice into something that was so beautiful and flowing, that had momentum, clarity, ease, playfulness. I really, really wanted to share this with other grad students and later writers, you know, novelists and authors, but it was just something that I was finding in my own process and I couldn't keep it to myself. So I was offering, and it was really great to see transformation. So it just kind of grew organically. And then, so the practice grew up, the dissertation coaching and writing coaching practice grew organically.
Yeah, that's amazing. I love that. I think that sometimes we don't expect the outcome to be what it is when we do things, do we? And I think that's such a nice way of finding out what our passions are, what brings us joy, and certainly helping others. But I really, what really resonated then when you were saying to me was around the isolation when it comes to writing. And I think it's something that when you undergo any kind of writing, but particularly something sustained like a PhD thesis or a book, I think the isolation thing's really an issue. I think sometimes we don't think it will be, that we'll just be quite happy to type away on our own and to get stuck in. But I don't know what you feel. Do you find that that's something that you think has helped your writing to sort of build more of a community around it, to have people that you can talk to about it and to share it with others?
Absolutely. Thank you for asking. It has been such an integral part of my writing. I can't even think about writing by myself. I've always written with friends or in the community. I've run like free writing group in my community for, I don't know, 8 years now, nine years now, because it's 2024. And always groups in the university. I don't know if I shared with you, but my first experience of writing with others was when I was 4 and a half. I was very proud of myself because my best friend was 2 years older and she taught me how to write. So we would gather in a little gazebo in our courtyard with my friends, neighbors, and everyone was older, but I could make, you know, little loops. So we would come together and we would write. And it was very simple. We would copy songs and I would just mostly look at how other people were writing and I was copying. But the experience of being together and creating something, quietly respecting each other's process, and also being together in that silence with the sound of, you know, rustling pages and pen and paper, is something that I treasure. And I'll tell you my favorite moment, if I may. In my writing groups in the university, students would often come and announce, they would come in and they would say, I hate writing. And I would say, great, sit right next to me on my right. That was like a magical spot. And after, you know, a few exercises, like maybe an hour of free writing exercises where I'm just taking off all their pressures, my favorite moment is when I have a gentle alarm, it goes off. I say, for example, write for 7 minutes, 8 minutes. My alarm goes off and those people who said I hate writing, they just keep writing. And then they look up, they look at each other and I say, you know, take a moment to finish. And they just keep writing. So that's my favorite moment. When the alarm went off and everyone writes, one day they went on for 9 minutes. Everyone was just enjoying their writing. And then at the end of the session, they announced to me, you know, I really think I like writing. And I say, my job here is done. So it's not the writing itself. It's all the things we put on it, right? All the pressures we put on it for ourselves and all the stories we tell. And so I think there is a stigma in sharing those because it's like a loop. I don't know. I would love to hear your opinion on this, but it's, you know, you have some stressful, you don't share them, you get isolated, then you keep thinking, oh, it's just me. And, you know, if I share, everyone else is doing just fine. It's just me. And so it feeds into the isolation. But, and maybe there's a stigma that if I come to the coach or to writing support, you know, or to the editor, they might claim I'm down or something I'm not supposed to ask for. And what people don't understand is what I find. I mean, I know so many writing coaches, including you. I hope it's okay to call you that. I know you're a book coach, but I hope it is. And they're all writers who do not hold their clients, you know, with any degree of judgment. It's always like, yes, I know the struggles. Let's look at it together. Because I don't think I've ever heard anything from a writer that I haven't experienced myself. Do you find that?
I do find that. And I like the fact that you call me a writing coach, actually, because more and more I've been thinking over the last few months that writing is writing, isn't it? And actually, whether you're writing something that's a short article, or whether you're writing a book, or whether you're just writing a newsletter or something that means you're putting yourself out into the world, you are sharing things that maybe you've never shared before. It's a liberating experience when you can open up to it, and when you can, like you said, get rid of that, the expectation that you may have put on yourself, or the things that you're bringing with you from other people's perceptions of your writing, or whatever it might be. And I like that. I think that's what I find I'm thinking about myself more and more as, is a writing coach rather than just predominantly a book coach. And yeah, no, it's so interesting that you said that, because actually that's how I've started to see myself. But you're right. I think we come to the experience of writing, don't we, with so much of an opinion of what we think it might be or what it should be. And actually, it's none of the things we ever think it's going to be, because that's the beauty of creativity, right? We come to it, and we should be open-hearted, and we should be embracing the challenges, because actually that teaches us so much about ourselves, so much about the process, so much about what we feel towards the art of writing itself. And your point about when they say, and they come into the session, they say, I hate writing. I've had people come to me before when they're writing books, and they will be halfway through or maybe a little bit further, and they'll say, I hate my book. I hate it. I don't want to see it ever again. And I think it's such a shame, because what started off with enthusiasm and excitement and motivation, somewhere along the way, that's got lost. And to be able to reignite that in somebody is, I think, a real privilege, and something that I feel very lucky to be a part of. Because when you can get that excitement back, that motivation back, and that love of what you're trying to do back, it can be, you can just see the difference in their mannerisms, just they have a little twinkle in their eye again. They're genuinely excited. And to be part of that is, for me, such a joy. And I'm sure you must find that too.
Can I just acknowledge all the words you're saying? They're just landing so deeply. I think that's why I resonate with your messaging so much. Especially the first word that got me was liberating. I agree with you. It's like liberating the joy of the process from all the things we put on it. And then you said open-heartedness, and then joy, and you like to ignite something in people. So I resonate with all of that. It's like an inherent sparkle of creativity, or spark or sparkle, both. And then, you know, it gets covered up either by other people's opinions, by our well-wishing teachers. Sometimes I hear, you know, people get feedback and it just cuts them. I've certainly experienced that. So I really love how you say that. And I sense in you a certain openness to and curiosity to the process, like when we don't know in advance. I mean, I know you love outlines. I do too. I'm not against outlines, but I think after the outline comes a certain abandon, and you just kind of write in the moment. You're not thinking about the outline, right? Maybe you took an item, or you know, a point from your outline, and then you just kind of let go and you allow yourself to find out what is going to happen. And so for me, this adventure and joy, it requires, I guess, a certain openness, but with that openness comes joy, right? And then we're more open to other people's feedback. If we've enjoyed what we've written, then it's not about, this is mine and I need to protect it. It's like, what do you think? Do you see what I see? And if you don't, thank you for your time and attention and helping me see it through your eyes. It's exciting, you know? And it's like courage, I guess.
Yeah. It is courage. And I think we're, you know, I was thinking about this recently around the vulnerability of being a writer, and having to lean into the fact that not everybody will like what you do. Not everybody will, you know, find your work meaningful to them, and being able to accept that as part of the creative process, whatever you do, whether you're a writer or an artist or an architect or whatever it is, where you're creating something from nothing, you feel so attached to it. And I guess rightly so, because it means, if you've put your heart into it, then it does mean something. And I think that's the the tricky bit about being creative and being a writer is knowing that at some point someone will say, oh, I didn't think that was very good, or I didn't like that, or I wouldn't read that again, or I wouldn't recommend that book. And if it's your book, I think we can be very flippant when we talk about other art like that. You know, when we think about shows we might watch on Netflix, and how often I'm chatting to my friends about what we've just watched recently, and one of us will say, oh no, I really didn't like that. I couldn't, I switched off after the first episode or first couple of episodes. And then there'll be someone else in the group who's, oh, I don't know, I loved it. It was my favorite thing so far this year. And actually that's somebody's creative work that we're so almost flippantly saying love it or hate it, but actually that's just part of it, isn't it? It's just knowing that actually you're not going to please everyone, nor should you try to. You should just be who you are, and then hopefully you'll find the right people who then become fans of what you do and enjoy your work, and that's who you end up writing for, really.
I have to share something with you, if I may, because I've suffered from paralyzing fear of feedback for many, many years, and I couldn't get through to it by myself. So I always wrote, but I never shared. Even my best friend said, you never shared. So I remember I had to work with a therapist through that, and I remember the moment I worked through that fear, and I want to share it because it was so paralyzing. The book that I self-published by myself, I sat on it for 3 years, in paralyzing fear of feedback and just thinking, it's not good enough, I'm not good enough, I'm never going to publish. I almost like scrapped the whole process because I got feedback from an editor whom I admired, and she ripped it to pieces. And it's fine, not really, but it felt like that. You know, it felt like that. And so it took courage. And what I found is this. I think there was a great lesson there, because she gave me a sample. She took one page, maybe even half a page, and she rewrote it how she would, you know, write it. And I really admired her. I went for the best. I contacted the editor of my favorite book. I'm not going to name, well, one of my favorite books. But I said, I want to work with you because I love that book. So I really respected and admired this person right away. And when I accepted all the changes on my half page, I really didn't like it. It didn't feel like me. So there I was, with admiration and great respect for the editor, and fearing I will not be able to put these words as mine. Never. Like, this is a different style. This is not me. So, you know, I ended up trusting myself more, and, you know, kindly, gently saying, thank you so much. I won't be working with you, unfortunately, which was devastating. But I think without it, I wouldn't have found the trust and the courage to just receive the feedback. But I can't let someone change my work so much that it doesn't feel like me. I literally felt like kind of nauseous. So I have to choose myself. And then I noticed this pressure of awaiting feedback, right? And just like, oh, what will people say? Both with my book and with my dissertation writing, from my supervisor, who's basically God when you're doing your PhD. But I think it was in teaching a class that my students showed it to me. I felt this pressure. You know, I've done thousands of presentations and workshops, and I love doing them with live audience. But I was going in, and I was like, what is this nervousness? It's like extra nervousness. And I realized, oh, I want them to like my presentation. I see myself as a great teacher. I always do great presentations. I need them to like me. And I caught it, and it was a pressure, and I put it down. So I walked in that class, and I was like, listen, they can like me, they can go to sleep, they can, you know, text with their friends, they're free. They're free from needing to like me. And I just went in because I love material. I'll talk to anyone about writing. And I felt so free, and I didn't need anything from them. Guess what they were? They were all like this, right? They were like all eyes on me, because they could feel I didn't need anything from them. So with my work, with my books, I understand the audience and I care, but I really write for myself, and the job is complete. Once I finished the piece and I revised it and I worked with my editor, if I like it, if it's acceptable, if I can live with it, it's not perfect. It's never perfect. Like, I would always give my books like 2 stars because I can take it apart, but I let it go and I say, my audience are welcome to like it, read it, throw it away, hate it. They're welcome to see it the way they need to see it. I gratefully accept that they would even spend time with my work. I don't need it. And then once you know it, it's all 5 stars, right? And I'm surprised. I'm like, I wasn't rating for 5 stars. I was rating for myself. And I don't know if you find it, but the transformation is complete. Once you get something out of your system, of course I'm thinking who I'm rating for. I always have like the image of one specific person. It's my humble attempt to share what I see, and that's it. In my limited experience, knowledge, emotional intelligence, this is what I see in this moment in time. I will grow wiser. I will see something else. But at this moment, I want to offer this. This is all I see. And I accept that someone will say, hey, you missed that. I'll be like, oh my gosh, I totally did. So there comes like a little relaxation, or maybe not little, but it's like when you don't require anything of your audience, then you can allow yourself the joy and just playfulness. You play, and I mean, I always revise 100 times. I made a joke on Instagram recently. I was like, if I can go from 100 revisions to 70, I'm a champion. And I'm exaggerating, but I believe we can always refine our work, and I love it. It's delicious, you know, fine-tuning, wordsmithing. But ultimately, there comes a point where you're like, I feel it's done here, and then I just let it go.
I think it comes down to that good is good enough, right? And if we're looking for perfection, we're never going to find it, and we're never going to publish. And I wonder whether sometimes that need for perfection when it comes to our work is actually a lack of confidence, in maybe in disguise, a bit of procrastination. I think it disguises itself where we think, oh no, I know I can do another round of edits, or I just want to read it one more time, or I just want to make these tiny changes. And actually, when it comes to it, is it going to have an enormous impact on the reader? Probably not. As long as we've got as much as we can give the reader in the book, those tiny tweaks are more for us. And actually, you know, getting it out there is so much more important. And yeah, okay, like you say, if you have to make any changes or things are caught, then you can think, okay, well, if you're self-publishing, it's easy, isn't it? You can just do you can upload a different draft, you know, have something where you maybe, if there's something that you majorly missed, which I, you know, for both of us, we're both professionals, right? We wouldn't put something out there that wasn't as good as it could be. But I think there's that freedom there around, you know, if there was something glaringly missing or whatever the problem was, we can always make those changes and get it out there in a newer form. But it's for a lot of people, I think it's a matter of, you know, you've just got to release it in the best way, the best shape it's in. Let's just get it out there. And most people, you know, 99% of people are just going to, you know, are going to love it the way it is. And if there's somebody who points out there might be a grammatical error or a spelling, you know, anything like that, then you just got to think, thanks very much. But, you know, actually, that really doesn't matter in the grand scheme of everything that goes into a book. The odd missing comma isn't really going to manage to damage things too much, I don't think.
I think it's really perceptive of you to point out that moment, because I recognize it as a writer and as a coach when it's, you know, obsessively continuing to revise because I need it to be perfect because it's a representation of me in the world. And now it's inviting people into my work and seeing feedback as part of my growth. It's like, you know, being a 5-year-old kid and finding, I don't know, special rock on the ground and saying, do you see what I found? Do you see? And then other people tell you what they see from other, where they stand, right? From their point of view. It's actually using my work to grow. Like, I'd never realized, I thought it was all about you put out the perfect product and you await evaluation, you know, but it's really conversation. Like when I first shared my book, I was such a newbie. I learned everything about self-publishing, but I remember going and finding some kind of metric and seeing where it was downloaded. It was 44 countries in the first like months, and it blew me away. Someone, you know, in Zimbabwe downloaded my book, and I could hear me share about my life and what I was finding about my own process, and it was mind-boggling then starting these conversations with people who would write reviews, and they would reach out sometimes because I put my email in my book. People, I don't do that, but it's really the connection with the reader. It's not like this is the perfect book. It's really like, here's what I see at the moment. Do you want to join this conversation with me? And my goodness, if someone wants to talk to me about writing and, you know, self-discovery, what they're finding, what a beautiful opportunity. So the book is just a tool to connect, because ultimately, I know, I guess I'm contributing myself, which is great. I love a paradox. So I write it for myself, but then I love, so when I write it, it's kind of for myself, but then its purpose is not to keep it to myself. It's for others. It's like a tool for connecting with others, and that's it.
I love that. I love that. Because I always talk to authors when I'm working with them around the importance of connection, and how if we're asking a reader to spend time with our work and to make it to the end of the book, which is something that doesn't always happen. People pick up books and they start them and they never finish them, or they start them and they think, oh, I'll come back to it. And they don't. And that's because life gets in the way, or, you know, cat videos on Instagram get in the way, or whatever it might be. And I think we, to give us a chance, to give our work a chance, if we can establish connection to the reader through what we're saying and the stories we're telling and how we try to share our own story and our own journey, we're more likely to establish that connection. And like you say, I love it when people reach out to me and tell me that they've read my books, or how my books help them, or even this podcast. You know, occasionally I get people who will email me and say, oh, I love this particular episode you did. There's just something that, you're right, we're not doing it for that reason. But actually, when that happens, in whichever medium you're being creative in, it's such a joy to have that chance to talk to the person who's read the book and to ask them, you know, let's engage in conversation. What bit did you find the most helpful? Or, you know, how are you doing with whatever the thing they're trying to do is? And I think that's such a privilege as a creator to be able to have that connection. So you're absolutely right. Connection is 100% key to a successful book, in my opinion, anyway.
And I really love this, topic that you've highlighted, that perfectionism is fine. We all understand it. Of course, I want to put out my best work. I mean, who doesn't? But I think we must examine the cost. In my case, it was years of procrastination and fear. I was paralyzed. My book was sitting in my drawer. I was devastated, and I knew that. So it wasn't just like, well, I'm still working on my book. I couldn't put it out. And so when the cost of perfectionism is joy or connection with others and isolation, I don't want it. So I'll always choose joy and connection and imperfection, because I don't know, I think perfection does not build connection, right? I love making a fool of myself in the classroom. I love, you know, I love putting out my Instagram posts that are not perfect, or my videos. I say, there's the imperfect video, because here I was, and because I don't want to spend the afternoon editing, I want to spend the afternoon going for a walk with my husband. Therefore, first take, you know, forgive me, the makeup and hair team, we're not there.
Yeah, you're right. Get it out there. That's what I say. Just, you know, just get out what your best version of whatever it is, and then be happy that you did it. Because I think we forget what an achievement to get a book out there, or to get anything out there that we've spent time on. It's such an achievement, and often, maybe writers more than any other medium, I'm not sure, but that's just my guess, is that we seem to berate ourselves and we seem to not recognize the milestones that we achieve. And we think we have to wait until we've hit publish to celebrate, or we have to wait until we've sold X amount of copies, or, you know, we've been on, you know, whatever it is, podcasts or interviews, or we've written and we're seen as some sort of absolute shining example before we can even admit that we're proud of ourselves, or we are excited about what we've managed to do. And I think we need to be sharing the journey more, but we also need to be celebrating these little things that we do, getting to the end of a chapter, getting to the end of a draft, you know, just all these parts of writing, and not waiting until we've, you know, whatever that we perceive success to look like, waiting until we've achieved that.
I would even add more. I completely agree with you. I would even add more. I would kind of like stretch your point to say, if we can find that enjoyment and fulfillment, then even celebrating the start, you know, like you, I'm coming, here's my morning, I'm putting in 30 minutes today because I get to field. So I want to say two things. Every I have to that comes up in my head, I examine, especially every I should. But I have to feels like, I have to. But for myself, I change it to I get to write. I get to come to my page. You know, my friends are yoga teachers. They come to the mat. I come to the page. That's my practice. What joy. And so then the moment of you mentioned success or joy or celebration. For me, we don't have to even put it at the end of the chapter or at the end of the book. If we start from I get to, then here we are writing from the joy and fulfillment. And then if we get to the chapter, we're extra champions. Like, I don't know, we get two medals, but something like that. And I like being playful. I tell my students, you know, sometimes like celebrate every page. If your goal is to write 5 pages today or 2 pages today, you know, whatever it is, put 2 pieces of chocolates on the right side of your desk or something. And after each page, just take it. Or if it's not a chocolate, some people, they're so creative with a reward system, but I help them set it up. They're like, my child crocheted me something. And so it's the matter of taking the little toy or little, I guess, flower that the child crocheted and just putting it from the right to the left. It's just something. Or, you know, little marbles from, you know, one side of the desk to the other. And so you just see it traveling. And I always encourage people, I don't know if you've tried it. With my first book, I had little place in the room where I just put all my to-dos kind of from waist up on the top of the wall, and then under the imaginary line above my waist, I would just move all the things I've accomplished underneath. So I remember moments, we all get moments when we want to give up and it's too hard and it's too overwhelming, like I'm walking away for sure this time. And then you look at the bottom of the wall, you look at all the post-its, you're like, oh my God, everything you set up, look at how much I'm done. And so you support yourself, because those moments don't happen when you have people around. You know, for me, it's like 1 a.m, 2 a.m, and, you know, the 17th inquiry with Amazon or KDP, you know, Kindle customer service, and you're like, is it even worth it? But then you have to find ways to support yourself, celebrate yourself, because when no one else is there, are you there for yourself? So.
Oh, I love that. Yeah, I think you're so right. And I love the idea when you were saying about if you were a yoga practitioner, that you would turn up to the mat and do your practice. And I think you're right. I think we fail to see just showing up is something to be celebrated in itself, because it's so much easier sometimes to think of everything else you could do or you might want to do instead, because especially when you're going through a particularly tricky part of your manuscript or, you know, the work you're trying to do, it's, you know, you almost look for any reason to do anything else. And then actually just to celebrate thinking, no, you know, even if you only do 10 minutes, you know, I always say that to people, it's more just the fact that you're proving to yourself that you can and that you will, and that you often get the motivation to carry on sometimes, even if you think I'm only going to do 10 minutes. And like a little bit like you were saying about your students who come in and you say, we're going to write for this amount of time, and actually they want to write for longer. I think the same thing sort of happens to me sometimes when I think, oh, I'm just not feeling it today, so I'm just going to do a few minutes. But actually, once I'm in the flow, it's, you know, more often than not, I'm cracking on then for the next half an hour. It's just that almost that initial hurdle of getting, you know, started is the issue. And actually just celebrating doing that is so important.
You're right. It's a trick. It's like, you know, sometimes I'll say, well, just write one sentence or two sentences. And also I think it's about, a lot of it is about trust. I will say, you know, you have to trust yourself to come, not to write the most perfect novel in the world, right? Or the most impactful dissertation, because try to write with that on your head, right? Like, my dissertation has to make this grand discovery. I've seen it so many times. But you have to trust yourself that you will try, that you will come, that you will show up. I remember being so nervous before my defense. You know, I sought advice from my wise mentor, and he said, you have to come. Like, all you have to do, you have to show up and say something, because, you know, that's all you have to do. But trusting ourselves, trusting other, we already talked about the audience, trusting them to be kind. Like, they are people who will read your work, and that's a privilege that they will give you their time. And then they will tell you honestly, but not in the, you know, spirit of meanness, they will just share what they see, and that's a privilege. But also, I trust my practice. So, I usually have a dual goal. When I was finishing my dissertation, it was 2 pages or 2 hours. And if I come and I knock out 2 pages in 10 minutes, I'm free for the day. But if I come and it's one of those days when nothing is happening, I just keep moving paragraphs, then I sit there for 2 hours and then I'm free. I get up and I move on with my day, because guess what? Tomorrow, I come back at 9 o'clock. It's very liberating. And what I found is I learn no matter what. Whether I wrote my pages or I didn't, I learned something about myself, my fears, my beliefs about writing. And I found, you know, I've been writing for 35 years now. Yeah, 35 years now. I started, you know, journaling when I was 13. I'm going to be 49. But I found that beliefs we hold about writing are no different than beliefs we hold about life. So writing is my professional, personal, and spiritual practice. It's my teacher. So I learn everything from my practice. So I come to it, I always, you know, joke like I'm a disciple of writing, but the word is not discipline. Disciple comes from like love, you know, you love and you fall. So I just come to my writing to bow to it and see what else can I discover today? What will it teach me today? Not as a master, never as a master. I think Hemingway said, we're all apprentices in the craft where no one ever becomes a master. And I really see writing practice as something bigger than me. It's just, it saved my life. It, you know, gave me the most fulfilling job in the world, whether it was in the university or now in my old practice. I see it as such a rich opportunity to grow, to see, to notice, to relax, to surrender, to be open, to accept so many things I learned from writing. So I'm, you know, this podcast may go on for 24 hours because talking to someone like you who is a writer and a coach, it's just such a privilege and a joy to talk about something we both love.
Yeah, I'm like you. I could talk about it forever, but yeah, it is a joy. And I always feel really lucky to have found something that I feel so excited about and brings so much to my life through, like you say, just the practice of it, and to be able to support others in their practice of it. How does your environment, do you find your environment impacts how you approach your practice or what's successful for you? Or sort of, do you have something, do you sit anywhere particular? Do you find that different environments help for different things? How does that work for you?
It's a great question. Yes. The simple answer is yes. I feel the energy of my environment goes directly into my work. So now that when it gets a little bit warmer, I mean, I attempted yesterday, but it was storm by the lake. And I tried to write by the lake. I will attempt on a sunny day in winter as well, but I'm in Canada. So I feel it's not the time that I put in, it's the energy and the quality of my attention, the quality of my seeing. So I love writing in nature and writing with others. So I feel kind of connected. I don't know, nature makes me feel more harmonious, I guess. I feel at peace and I feel the rhythms of the nature, they are kind of kinder. I'm not pushing, I'm not trying to get anything out. I'm more connected to myself and the world. So I feel I infuse it with the waves, with the sun, with the sky. I guess I like having like a clear desk because it helps my clarity. I don't know if it's the same for you, you know, but I try to change. I used to write in coffee shops, but now I prefer natural environment or something with perspective where I have a window or, you know, I'm on the beach or even if I'm in the park, I like having open space because I feel it kind of mirrors what I need. I need to become spacious for what's coming. I don't know whether it's downloaded or, you know, something that I'm opening up to because even if I come with a plan. So I try to, I'm sure it's the same for you. I think I've seen it in some of your posts, but just minimizing distractions. I guess squirrels, I can't minimize squirrels, but no phone, no notifications, just, and often I will, when I'm composing, so I guess different stages of the writing process, composing and revisions require different environments. You're nodding, so probably you can resonate with that, but often when I'm composing, it's pen and paper, it's longhand, often, if it's summer. And then revisions are done. It's, you know, sometimes I have background music, sometimes in a different language. Like I enjoy mantras, whether it's, you know, Buddhist mantras or about mantras in Hindi. So I enjoy just something that's devotional music, for example, or instrumental or classical love. So those three, something where I'm not following the words, you know.
No, yeah, I completely agree that. Yeah, I can't write with anything with lyrics. I just can't do it. I find that then they just weave their way into my thought process and I can't concentrate. So I'm like you. That's interesting about a different language. I've never thought of that before. I tend to just go instrumental, classical, or sort of like jazz that's very sort of light and relaxing, nothing with too much I guess rhythm and pace. I find that I like to have something soothing. There's something definitely about the right kind of music, I find, for my writing practice. I always have certain playlists that I've got on Spotify that I just go to as sort of a matter of course. And I think it helps for me, for my brain to be like, okay, it's this music, so this means we're writing. It sometimes then will actually help me and partner up with my desire to get something on the page. And I think it helps me certainly to have little things that I do every time I write, just to help. I guess they're like little writing rituals that help me get into the zone, help me just realize that, you know, I'm here now. Like you said about the notifications, I make sure my phone's on do not disturb, I have the music on, and I tend to be the same sort of time of day, just because that again means that I've got it done when I'm at my best, because it's, I think it deserves my best effort. So I like to do it first thing before I do anything else. And then it's just that feeling that, oh, do you know what? I've done my writing practice for today and now I can get on with everything else that might be on the cards. So, yeah, I find rituals and things like that really helpful.
And
to
I
me.
Think because it's you and me, we must bring up a very important point that so many people resist. But I don't know if you find it, but with almost, with I would say 99%, maybe 99.9% of my students, I have to insist that that it's impossible to write for 15 hours a day, every day, 7 days a week. It's simply impossible. But they don't believe in me. And sometimes, you know, it's really painful. I was doing a talk in York University, and a student was saying, sometimes I sit and I write for like, I have a short assignment, but I work for 6 hours. And at the end of it, I don't have a paragraph because I've revised it so many times. I still again have a paragraph. Right. And I can hear that. I almost cried when she said that. And the whole classroom got quiet because everyone could relate to that. And to me, it's so painful. And so I think you and I, we found that it has to be, it cannot be for so long, because cognitive exhaustion is a thing. You know, people believe you cannot do that. And I think often people call something writing that's not writing. Planning is not writing. Outlining is not writing. You know, talking about your work to your grandma is not writing. Or definitely cat reels is not writing. So for me, you know, 25 minute or 30 minute, I switched from 30 to 25 minute sprints now. You know I'm writing. Like I can procrastinate all I want for the first minute or even two, you know, how decadent I moved papers on my desk, but I know that it's like timed procrastination. It's not even procrastination, it's easing into my work. And I know if I do it for 1 or 2 minutes, this is joyful. I'm just setting up. It's like plating your food, you know? And then I go, and then if I need to do 2, 3, 4 of the sprints, that's fine, but I will take breaks in between them. And so when I talk to people, yes, PhD is, or writing a book, it's a large project. But guess what? You know, I wrote 3 books in 3 years, and it was 30, 45 minutes a day. The rest is, yes, you can do research in the afternoon. You can, study something. You can try organizing it. This is fun, but just, you know, writing is writing. It requires a completely different presence in the moment. And I would say, you know, 2, 3 hours, maybe if someone is super talented, maybe if when you have like a deadline, maybe 4 hours tops, but with breaks in between, but you can do it for 8 hours, 10 hours a day, you will be more productive. I had, you know, I was helping a student or a client, and she wrote like, it's not uncommon for people to write 2 hours a day or 1 hour a day, and then they have like 15 pages or 20 pages in a week. Like, you don't need much more. That's plenty. I didn't remember the number of words, but it was blowing them away, because we were just going for like 500 words a day. And then like, well, I wrote 2,500 today. I was like, what? How long did you write? Well, really just like 2 hours. So it's the playfulness, the ease, and just like the diving in, right? The trust. And because we inhale and we exhale, so we can just be writing. And I noticed that when I take students on a retreat, yes, it's an environment where everything is provided for you. You have food, you don't have any chores or, you know, your children. So you can write for 15 hours a day, but you shouldn't. So I always kind of push their chairs out on the lawn, like literally. And those who came second and third time, they say, listen to her. The first time she was like, go for a walk, go for a walk. There's a beach, there's a park. And I was like, why are you making us go for a walk? We're here to write. But then they got sick, burnt out, and couldn't finish. And so the second time they found their rhythm, and they tell the people who came the first time, listen to her, go for 15 minutes, 30 minutes.
No, I was going to say, I think that just makes me think back to Bird by Bird by Anne Lamott, where she talks about the fact that a lot of blocks come from emptiness. We're creatively empty because we've exhausted ourselves through trying to put our words on the page. And I know that she advocates for getting out and doing things that replenish that creative cup, that fill you up with more ideas and more energy and more joy for the process. And that just made me think of that, because I think what happens is when people sit for so long to write, and they assume that they have to be called a writer, that you should be sitting at the desk for all this time. And actually, I don't believe that's what makes a writer. What makes a writer is putting words on a page, however long it takes, in terms of, even if it's half an hour, that you're still a writer. It doesn't mean that you're any less. But I think you're right. It's all the other things that we have to do to replenish that creativity, to fill us with ideas and, you know, that excitement for the project. And that can come from walking, it can come from sitting with friends, it can come from reading or listening to music or whatever it is that just brings that energy level back up. And like you said, I think energy plays such an important part in the writing process and in how much we love the writing process. Because if we feel depleted and we feel resentful to writing because it makes us, you know, we have been trying to sit for 6 hours a day, then of course we're not going to want to do it. We're going to feel as though we have to do it. And then that then leads to you just not enjoying it and just not wanting to do it. And I think it's about finding all the ways we can to help people to enjoy it for what it is, but not to feel as though it's something that they are required to do in any length of time or in any particular way. It has to be right for the individual.
Yes, I pay much closer attention to energy, the quality of my attention, clarity and balance and rhythm, than I am to time, because time is a non-renewable resource and energy is. So it's, and really noticed that it matters if I'm tired or sleepy like I am now. It doesn't matter if I spend 3 hours in front of my screen, but if I take a cold shower, if I go for a little jog, or if I sit in meditation or whatever I need, and I can come back fresh, clear, then in 10, 15 minutes, I can move mountains, and you know that. So I paid, I remembered what I was trying to say, with myself. And I work with a lot of people who are neurodiverse, and then it's just, there seems to be a moment where we get into the groove of doing something passive, which is like reading, you know, I have 50 articles to go through, or all these wonderful craft books about writing, and we just slip into this passive mode of receiving or listening or watching, and we're not doing, or we write, and then we try to write on empty, right? Like you said, we reach a point where we've said everything we wanted to say. So I'm watching that. If I'm doing something passive, it's also for 25 minutes. So I don't go into the dark hole of research, because we all love reading, we all love researching, and it's so easy to do. But it's games I play with myself. If it's like, after every two paragraphs or one paragraph or one page, I will write something down, whether it's my gut reaction to the text, you know, or a question I want to ask the author. It's whatever it is, but I will produce some kind of an output. And then if I'm writing, like you said, you have to stop and refill your well. I don't know if you're familiar with the Earth Date by Julia Cameron. Yeah, the once a week, a solo expedition adventure where you don't invite anyone and you go by yourself, whether it's museum or gallery or walk or, you know, you're doing something to fill that well. I really love that. I don't always do it every week.
No, but you're right. I think it's, and also it's about that time by yourself as well. I think we sometimes feel like, I wonder whether we, as we've evolved over the, you know, these last, well, certainly in this sort of the modern era around, that we find it hard to be left alone with our thoughts and ourselves, and that we're always looking for distraction, and we maybe feel like perhaps it's overindulgent to do those things, to think you're going to take yourself somewhere like that, or you're going to go somewhere just for you. And you're right, it's so important when it comes to how we feel about the creativity, how we feel about our energy levels. But I think sometimes those places are remarkable for idea creation and thoughts. You can just be left alone and something can spark something within you that you then feel, actually, that's just what I needed today to give me an idea for a character. Or it can just be, you know, just giving you a different perspective on something. And I think that's a wonderful reminder that actually we should be doing more of those things for ourselves and just for ourselves. And it's not selfish. It's just part of looking after ourselves and finding enjoyment in life itself.
And I find, you know, I find camaraderie with people who are my students or my colleagues, coach other coaches like you, but also I feel so connected to the community of writers who have come before me. And I love reading journals by famous writers. I love reading what they wrote about their craft and their process. And, you know, most of them went on solitary walks to think. And so for me, I'm not necessarily alone. I'm in good company, you know.
And we can learn so much, can't we, from those that have done it before, and actually just recognizing that everyone's writing journey is their own, and that we can learn from others and we can feel inspired, but actually how we go about it is purely the way that we should go about it because that's right for us. But I absolutely agree. I find a lot of motivation and inspiration from learning from others who've trodden the path, you know, either really successfully or who've struggled. But it's just noticing, isn't it, and making those connections, I suppose, between my journey and those that have other people that are doing it or have done it. So yeah, that's, I love that. Just before we finish, and I've loved this conversation, I've not even glanced at my questions at all because I've just been enjoying our conversation. But I just thought, I always end by asking people, you know, what, because I know you obviously work with people around block and, you know, feeling like, you know, maybe they're stuck. And I think both of us, I think more, maybe you more than me, are somebody who, you know, really help people with that aspect of it. And I think that a good question for me to ask you is, you know, if there's an aspiring writer listening or somebody who's already on their journey, what, you know, what do you think is a really, some really creative ways maybe, and I know your book does cover these, but what, you know, are some really simple ways that people can get through these kind of creative blocks they may be feeling, or this feeling of, you know, worry about judgment and things like that, all these things that can stop us. What are a couple of things that you think you recommend often to students?
Okay, I love it. Thank you so much. So I would immediately examine, I would ask myself, what unrealistic pressure am I putting on myself? Whether it's, you know, to write 10 pages in the next hour or to produce the quality. So I would just notice them right away. I would invite everyone to make a list of those unhelpful thoughts, because we might think there's 100 of them or thousands of them, actually, because it feels so overwhelming. But it's really, what I find is, like, each one of us has 4 or 5 favorite ones and they're just playing on a loop. So I would write them down, unhelpful thoughts, so we can have a distance. And then I would talk to them, you know, if I'm expecting great quality, like for it to be the best piece of work, I would drop my expectations. I would just kindly reframe and find a kinder, more compassionate belief about my writing. So I would relax those. Another fun thing could be imagining, you know, creating like a writing sanctuary for yourself, imagining, you know, your best environment and, you know, locking the door, even if you're somewhere in the valley, I don't know, but you're just locking the gate and leaving your inner critic outside of the gate, outside of your sanctuary. So they're not allowed to come in for at least 30 minutes. And also just imagining them as a, you know, as a child who will always offer ideas, and that's fine. That's their job. So sometimes if they come to, if you can identify those thoughts and the inner critic's voice, you can just say, you can imagine that you're giving the inner critic a computer, a laptop, or a piece of paper and pen and say, you write over here all your opinions about me and my work, and I'll write here, I'll be working on my, project, and then I'll come and check with you. So it's understanding that your relationship with your inner critic and with your, and with the thoughts and opinions it suggests about you, it's up to you. So you can, this voice comes to you, but you can believe it, but you don't have to. You can really just break up with this entity you never started a relationship with, just found yourself in relationship with, and you can find joy and tenderness and care in meeting your writer within and meeting that part of you that just wants to create, express itself, that's much kinder. So you can choose which relationship to nourish. And I think it's really empowering. And then you will learn everything from that part of you. That's your writer and your practice. And so the inner critic can just be left outside of your sacred place where you practice, your studio, your writing studio.
Yeah, that's such a nice way of thinking about it. I listened or read, I think, Eliz Gilbert quote where she talks, I think it was in Big Magic, and she was talking about how she likes to invite the inner critic along for the ride, but they're only allowed in the back seat of the creativity car, if you like, and that, you know, they can come along. Yeah, it's so good, isn't it, where that you can come along but you can't comment on the driving and you can't give me directions, but it's almost acknowledging that they're going to be there, like you say, that you've got this relationship with them, but how you contribute to that relationship with them, or how you allow them to contribute, is so in your control, more than I guess we think it is. We just assume that our inner critic's going to pipe up and there's nothing we can do about it. Well, they are going to be there, because that's just human nature, sadly, I think. But actually, we can manage how we interact with that inner critic and how much we listen. And I think that's such a, your idea of, you know, this is my sort of safe space, and, you know, I'm going to write in this space, and, you know, you can be over there. But you're not trying to get rid of it altogether, because that's not practical, but it actually is there, and it's just you can choose how you interact with it. And yeah, I thought that's lovely. That's really nice. Lovely point to end on, I think, just to remind everybody that we can stop our inner critics from sabotaging us, because I think that's what they're very good at, aren't they? Well, thank you for your time today, Natalia. But if anybody wants to find you, where can we find you on social media or your website?
I guess my website, writingdissertationcoach.com, and my handle on Instagram is Natalia Androps, it's just my name.
And I'll put all the links to those places in the show notes for everyone, so they can find you nice and easily. But yeah, thank you for your time.
Thank you so much.
I hope you enjoyed that episode with Natalia. She and I have such a similar way we approach the writing process. What I took from this conversation is how to embrace a more purposeful, almost spiritual side to my practice, to treat it with the love and respect it deserves, that I deserve when being creative. Often I'm so used to sitting and chucking the words out without stopping to appreciate the art itself. Natalia's words really struck a chord with me, and I've been working on a more intentional practice ever since. So thank you, Natalia. I hope you found it as inspiring and thought-provoking as I did. Natalia has such a brilliant way of expressing how she feels about writing, how she feels about life. And I do really feel like she and I are very kindred spirits when it comes to all things creativity. If you know anyone else who'd enjoy this episode, please do share it with them. I'll link to Natalia's Instagram and her books in the show notes so you can check out her work. And if you'd like to leave a review on your favourite podcast platform, I'd be very, very grateful. But until next time, happy writing.